Alles klar. Also, ich bin jetzt hier bei 2K, bei Civ Beyond Earth und bin hier mit Will Miller, der Lead Game Designer hinter Civ Beyond Earth. Und ja, ich mache jetzt ein vollstündiges Interview mit ihm. Das Ganze wird auch wieder auf Englisch laufen und ich hoffe, ihr habt viel Spaß beim Zuhören. So, hi Will.
Hi.
Okay, so you're the lead game designer behind Civ Beyond Earth, and I thought about making two parts of this interview. One part will be a bit about yourself, actually, not so much about the game, because we're all students, and for us, you've kind of been living the dream. So I looked you up on the internet, and I read that you started game development with 17 even. Mm-hmm. That's younger than I am now, which I'm greatly relieved, because I'm still pretty young, but yeah, okay. You started game design at the age of 17, and then you actually graduated as Bachelor of Arts, or Bachelor of Fine Arts, mm-hmm. more precisely, and then got into game development. So at our university, we also get a Bachelor of Arts. And how did that tie into you becoming a game designer, and especially a programmer as well?
Sure. Well, quick correction. I'm actually the co-lead designer of Civilization Beyond Earth. My best friend, David McDonough, is the other lead designer. And the two of us together are the creative team behind the product.
All right.
He just had a new baby, so he's back at home taking care of him.
Okay.
And that's why he can't be here. And he's also fixing all the bugs that I made in the game, probably. So, but yes, I did get started in this in games pretty early. When I was 17, I had just gotten a car. And I needed to pay for gas. And so I got a job at the local supermarket and was promptly fired from that. And then I applied to this ISP, this internet service provider in my hometown, and did not realize that they were also a small Mac game development studio as well.
Okay.
They were called Green Dragon Creations.
Okay.
And they made a game in 1996 called Grids, which was moderately popular.
But
anyway, the Mac game industry is a very small place. So once you're in, you know basically everybody. I actually met the guy that ports all of the Civ games, or has ported many of them for us, like back when I was 17 or 18 at Macworld one year.
So, unfortunately, my batteries ran out, so most of the interview was lost. But I'm gonna go with the last question. What is one tip you would give up and coming game designers, students?
I would say that engineering and programming is the key and the gateway to making your own games. I think increasingly there are tools out there that make things easier and that obfuscate a lot of the details of game design. But try to make a game in as low level a language as you can. Make one in C or C++ instead of Unity for a change. You know, like learning the low level there is important. And that's your paintbrush. You know, the more you understand the tools of your trade, the better you're going to be at executing your own games. Because often you don't have a huge team working for you, and you have to do it yourself.
So, also, it's probably good to be a jack of all trades.
Well, you have to specialize too. I mean,
we
look for people with a lot of depth in specific areas, but a broad experience.
All right.
So, Sid Meier is probably the best example of this I can think of. He is an excellent programmer. But he also has interests everywhere, and I wouldn't classify him really as a hardcore gamer. He's a fan of history and railroads and World War II and Gettysburg. And, like, that's where his games come from, right? Is this broad interest. So in college, you have this unique opportunity to try lots of things and to develop those kinds of interests.
All right.
So I've seen a lot of game development students that are hyper-focused on just games, and the things that they make as a result are derivative. So you really need to develop a cool personality and be a well-rounded person, in addition to acquiring some of these hardcore computer science skills.
Right, that's actually really reassuring about our course of study. So, to get to the second part, I'm going to keep it a bit short because I guess we don't have that much time left.
They'll tell us. They'll tell us.
All right. We're going to go for Civ Beyond Earth. I've watched a couple of trailers, I've read a few bit of stuff on the internet, and there's one point coming up again and again, and that is sometimes Civ Beyond Earth looks like just a reskin of Civ 5. So what would you do to prevent this, and how would you correct me on that statement?
Sure. It was really important for us that Civ 5 players feel comfortable. with the game right off the bat. We didn't want to have to teach them an entirely new game, and in addition to all of these new systems that we added. And it's built on Civ 5 technology, so there, you know, there's some constraints there. But the game is entirely new, but retains what we call the DNA of Civilization. So things like one unit per tile, the way that cities work, and tiles, and improvements, and resources work, all of that is maintained. Diplomacy, the way you interact with other civs, is maintained. But a lot of the underlying foundations for these, the guts of these systems, have been overhauled. And then, of course, the new system. So the nonlinear tech progression, the tech web instead of a tech tree, is a huge and fundamental change to the way the game works. The affinity system, which is kind of the backbone of the game's, of many of the game's systems. An expanded social policies, the new virtue system, covert operations. The orbital layer, of course, is a big addition to the game. So there's a lot here that Civilization players will find brand new.
All right. So basically, what you're saying is that the vision you had is still staying the same, or basically the same as all Civ games, because obviously it's a Civ game. There are just enough features to, basically make a new game out of it.
Well, we use what the 30-30-30 rule. It's like 30% the same, 30% improved, and 30% brand new. And I'd say, like, it's not quite that. I'd say there's more brand new in this game than just 30%.
Okay.
But there are some things that we maintain, because Civilization traditionally has incremental progress. And the leap from 4 to 5 was pretty dramatic with hexes and one unit per tile and all that stuff.
Okay, yes. Sir.
You, I think, will see other fundamental leaps like that, but at a lower frequency than what we've got here. But there are huge differences in the way that this game plays. And it might look on the surface kind of like a sci-fi version of Civ 5, but if you treat it that way, you'll lose.
Okay.
It'll kick your butt. I mean, it really is a lot different.
So about this affinity system, basically, it's three ways you can interact with your environment, and all three have win conditions, let's put it that way, attached to them. So when choosing this rule of three, did you go by like sort of a rock, paper, scissors principle that they counter each other, or why did you make this decision?
They're not really, don't think of them like races in, say, StarCraft or something like that. they're more play styles. Okay, so the purity playstyle, for example, is all about brute force. More guns, more strength, a very blunt instrument. The supremacy playstyle is about battlefield geometry and finesse. So their individual units are weaker, but worked in combination with each other, they can be very powerful. And harmony is about using the environment to your advantage. So a lot of the things that were detrimental to you early in the game, like the toxic miasma, for example, or the aliens, can work to your advantage. So they're sort of playstyle oriented, but they also encompass more than that. They're sort of a post-human trajectory for your entire civilization. So mm-hmm. they're like religion and evolution and governance kind of all rolled into one idea.
Okay.
So they affect a lot more than just the military units. Your cities begin to change appearance, or the leaders begin to change appearance as you invest in these affinities. And they really color the diplomatic landscape as well. So if I have a neighbor who's going down a different affinity trajectory than I am, there's going to be some tension there. It's the point of conflict in the late game.
All right. So, one pretty specific question I have on the back of my mind. I thought it was a pretty obvious mechanic always in Civ has been the idea of AoE, mm-hmm. area of effect, that if you target one tile, surrounding tiles will be affected as well. How much is this going to be integrated in Civ Beyond Earth, and will it be integrated?
That's a good question.
There are some areas with it. Some of the more advanced units, when they explode, they actually splash damage stuff around it.
All right.
In terms of AoE, there's some satellites that have an area of effect that are bigger, not necessarily military.
All right.
But you'll find some stuff like that scattered throughout. We don't have any direct AoE weapons where you click a spot and just go boom on nine tiles. But there's always these extra connectors tacked on, which is going to have effects on the units around.
Okay, that's actually pretty awesome to hear. That's
and
nice.
The orbital layer is all about AoE.
Okay.
So when you launch a satellite into orbit, it affects the terrain below it in a radius.
Okay.
So they're domestic satellites that can improve your tiles or generate resources for you. That can remove or condense miasma.
Okay.
And then there are ones that can affect your military, kind of like great generals did.
Okay.
And
so buffs.
So buffs, right. And those that kind of Tetris game that you're playing in the orbital layer is a parallel territorial acquisition game to what's going on the ground.
So basically, it's parallel, you say. So does this mean, or how do interactions work at all in this orbital layer? Can I somehow directly interact with the satellites of my opponents? Are they
You can shoot them down.
Okay.
Actually, satellites are very weak, just as they would be in real life.
Okay.
So they have powerful effects, but are temporary. They will deorbit automatically after a certain number of turns, and they're also weak. So if I have a unit with anti-orbital strike capability, I can just take them down.
Yeah. What I meant was, can the satellites interact amongst each other? So can
No.
Okay.
So one satellite cannot shoot another, and this is realistic as well.
Yeah, sure.
Space combat in orbit just wouldn't work
because of gravity.
The orbital mechanics are prohibitive, and it also simplifies the system. The star of the show is always what's going on the ground.
Okay.
And we wanted a lightweight way to augment that, and that's why the footprints of the satellites can't overlap. So you have to be very careful of where you place them. They don't move, and they're temporary.
Okay.
So you're always kind of refreshing and competing for that space in orbit.
So from the feeling, it would be kind of like the spy system in Civ 5, I'm guessing?
In the sense that it's kind of parallel to the covert operation system in this game, much like the espionage system in Civ, is parallel to diplomacy. It's kind of a separate axis for diplomacy.
Yeah.
The orbital layer is a separate axis for the combat system and for your tile improvements as well.
Same as units that are on the ground, they just have a different function.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. Well, I would say that concludes the interview.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Unfortunately, most of the first part was lost. I still got it in my head. I'm going to write it down.
And if you have questions...
Yeah, send the PR reps for follow-up questions.
Sure. Sure. Awesome. So,
all right. Thanks a lot. Have a good rest of your GameCon.
Yeah.
That was my report. Snack.